today, we've heard a little bit, both from Valerie and from Anushka, about Flugel and the great masculine renunciation. And so what I wanted to do today is talk a little bit about what Flugel pronounced, what he talked about in the concept of the great masculine renunciation, set that in a little bit of context with Flugel, and think about the ways in which the great masculine renunciation has been discussed and perhaps renounced in and of itself. And then a couple of ideas that I've been thinking about around who the renunciation is by, what the renunciation was of, and how we might also think about moving that on to what I want to call picking up on somebody else's idea of the masculine enunciation and masculine pronunciation, if I may. So it's in chapter 7, entitled Sex Differences, in the 1930 book Psychology of Clothes, that Flugel proposes the great masculine renunciation and identifies its causes. This, he argues, was a shift away from masculine ornament and pride in male physicality. Helpful if I put up what he says on screen. He stated it was a time when men gave up their right to all the brighter, gayer and more elaborate and more varied forms of ornamentation. Men, he said, aimed at only being useful, and where clothes still exerted an influence, it was in the direction of being correctly attired and not elegantly or elaborately attired. Clearly associating this shift with the late 1780s and the French Revolution, and its aim to abolish wealth and rank, Flugel claimed that the, and I quote, democracy had no use for the gorgeous and complicated trappings which had flourished in a preceding age of absolutism and highly accentuated class distinctions. Thus, the striving for a democracy and diminishing of the class distinctions that have been expressed through, and I quote, elaboration and costliness of aristocratic costume, was reflected in men's clothing through a greater simplicity and uniformity and a greater approximation of what might be called plebeian dress. There's also a link here to Brummel, and I think Philip's going to talk a bit about Brummel in his talk, so there's a link here, and I'm not going to go into that too much. At all, in fact. Flugel also links this simplification to another ideal of the age, that work had become respectable. And so a man's significant moments in his life no longer took place in the drawing room or on the battlefield, but in the office, the workshop, the counting house, which had a long tradition of relatively simple dress for men. Following other popular propositions of the day and developing on discussions in earlier chapters of The Psychology of Clothes, where he discusses the differences between modern Western man and other historical primitive, his words not mine, societies, differences in sexual and gendered presentation. He notes, and I quote, modern man has a far sterner and more rigid conscience than modern woman. And his clothing, I quote again, abounds in features which symbolise his devotion to principles of duty, of renunciation and of self-control. And we heard a little bit about that earlier. The remainder of the chapter sees Flugel explore what he calls the social nature of sex differentiation implied, where he outlines why the great renunciation was taken up by men but not by women. He reiterates particular beliefs about the roles of men and women, where men have been more active in social and group life, and what he calls the natural division of labour on sex grounds. Sorry, that's a funny note. So I want to say a little bit more about Flugel more broadly and the kinds of things he was interested in. He saw psychoanalysis as a curative science, not only because not only does it cure the neuroses of individuals, it does this by dispelling the unreason that lies at their origin. The chapters that precede Sex Differences are dominated by Flugel's engagement with the legacy of 19th century anthropology, where his overt influences were Herbert Spencer's discussion of fashion and clothing in The Principles of Sociology and Edward Tyler's 1892 publication Anthropology. As Michael Carter notes in his essay J.C. Flugel and the Nude Future, Flugel was not strictly trying to explain the origins of clothes, but was intrigued by clothes' ambivalence, in that for Flugel, clothes were ambivalence incarnate. Part of Flugel's task in the early part of the book was to translate the three categories that we've again heard about of modesty, decoration, and protection into terms compatible with a developmental model of psychoanalysis. Like Freud, Flugel subscribed to a psychoanalytical version of the theory of social evolution made up of certain assumptions. In considering the three fundamental motives of bodily protection that I've explained, he proposed that many European thinkers, proposed by many European thinkers, Flugel concentrates on the motives of modesty and decoration. In a talk on BBC Radio in 1928, Flugel stated there were two fundamental conflicting tendencies, one to proudly exhibit the body, the other to modestly hide it. For Flugel, femininity and masculinity rested on a complex set of developmental processes whose aim was to produce the different mixtures of exhibition and modesty that are sexual identity. In his introduction to 1932, an introduction to psychoanalysis, he stated, and I quote, "The exhibitionist's instinct originally relates to the naked body, but in the course of individual development, it inevitably, in civilized races, becomes displaced to a greater or lesser extent onto clothes. Clothes are, however, exquisitely ambivalent, inasmuch as they both cover the body and thus subserve the inhibiting tendencies we call modesty, at the same time afford a new and highly efficient means of gratifying exhibitionism on a new level." End of quote. And as Carter observes, Flugel was rather flexible in his explanation of how femininity and modesty intersect and how masculinity and display relate to one another. Flugel's explanation for why men, generally, have a greater element of exhibitionism in their makeup, his words, was that men's elementary narcissism undergoes a greater degree of transformation by being displaced onto the body, from the body onto clothing attached to the body. And this makes men's dressing more eye-catching in traditional societies. The awkward problem facing Flugel, as he surveyed contemporary reality, is that the complete opposite of these normal sartorial operating conditions seemed to be in existence and led to his proposition of the great masculine renunciation. The final section of Psychology of Clothes is what's taken up by what Flugel calls the ethics of dress. And it's here he dealt with the question of what constituted good and bad dress and tried to formulate practical policies based on outcomes of mediation. Human nakedness and the nudist movement were important in his theory of clothing. He proposed that the reasons humans went about clothed were largely neurotic, irrational, and derived from an ability to, I quote, "allow ourselves an undistorted recognition of our bodies." What if, asked Flugel, these neuroses could be cleared away? What would we be like then, speculating in a future in which clothing could become obsolete? And we've heard about that already, and that we might keep just wallets. Flugel's desire to temper the dominance of the superego on the physical body led him to be a sympathiser of the nudist movement, a broadcaster of good news about the sun through the Sunshine League, and, perhaps more significantly, an advocate for reform of men's dress and was one of the founders of the Men's Dress Reform Party. And I just want to say a little bit about the Men's Dress Reform Party. This grew out of a clothing subcommittee of the New Health Society and consisted of a group of academics, doctors, theologians and authors. Despite arguing that in order to regain masculine power, men needed to take inspiration from feminism, the MDRP observed how men had seemingly become accessories to women and how men's clothing was simply a foil to follow women's. The MRDP noted differences in men's and women's clothing where, as Joanna Bourke has phrased it, men's dress expressed imprisonment and women's expressed emancipation. Linked to this idea of the imprisonment of men's bodies, the key argument for reform were around health, that men's clothing was restricting and men's dress reform would offer a large surface of skin for the life-giving action of the ultraviolet rays of sunlight, which, as Dr. Caleb Willems-Selleby argued in the article in Times, was the most precious medicinal and hygienic agent in the world. In terms of what, I've shown you a slide of what the MRDP were wearing. So they were advocating a Byron collar rather than starch collars, a loosely knitted tie. Conventional trousers were espoused in favour of kilts, or more importantly, shorts. And significantly, they argued for greater individuality in men's clothing. The MRDP was short-lived. By 1937, the New Health Society had been declared bankrupt. The clothing proposed and worn by the MRDP members was believed to display bad taste or was met with hostility. And this slide from Punch, I think, shows how people were kind of thinking about that. A former president of the Association of London Master Tailors stated that clothes were, quote, "more suitable for Lotus Land than England. An advocacy of shorts was met with hostility or at very least ambivalence." This proposition by Flügel of men's rejection of ornamentation and the withdrawal into monochromatic uniformity has been utilised in discussions of both dress and fashion, and I use both of those words, and there's not really time, I think, to go into that differential, particularly to differentiate and explain men's seeming disinterest in cycles of fashion and fashionability. And Jennifer, as noted by Jennifer Jones, as, quote, a dominant paradigm among gender and fashion historians, and summed up here by Jennifer Craik in her set of denials. However, equally and increasingly, Flügel's proposition has been seen as limited and simplistic. Anne Hollander simply stated, interestingly also in 1994, the truth is men have never abandoned fashion at all, but have simply participated in a different scheme. Similarly, Brouard's proposed that, I quote, rigorous attention to the rules and details of dress in itself constitutes an alternative fashion system. Despite pointing out the dominant paradigm, Jones also notes how important scholarly work on men's fashion had questioned details of Flügel's model. Her particular interest is in those who've explored the periods prior to that, identified as the beginning of the Renunciation. She explains how in his 2006 essay, Michael Kwas has explored men's relationships to wigs in the 18th century, and how these were embraced by men of all ranks, and provides a clear example of men's active participation in burgeoning 18th century consumer economy. As Kwas stated, the moralist critique that wigs symbolise the increasing effeminacy of men, and therefore should be rejected, does not seem to have held much purchase in the minds of male consumers before the very end of the 18th century. Also addressing the period before and during the GMR, I'm going to call it for brevity, David Kutcher particularly addresses questions of Flügel's chronology in his 2002 text, The Three-Piece Suit and Modern Masculinity. He pushes men's modern relationship with clothing back to the 17th century, where we see with the beginning of what we can identify as the three-piece suit. Specifically in relation to the great masculine renunciation, Kutcher identifies aristocratic and middle-class men's clothing becoming darker and simpler in the last decades of the 18th century as concomitant with reformation of manners. Highlighting a plain and uniform costume for men was not, Kutcher says, inherently or a historically middle-class ideal, but was a result of middle-class adoption of ready-to-wear aristocratic notions of masculinity. Kutcher cites various 19th century texts that echo in Flügel's notion and proposition, such as those here on the screen. Kutcher uses commentaries, courtesy literature, books of manners that advocated clothing could be as unostentatious as possible, separating fashion from manliness and gentility, both condemning luxury and feminising it, and advocating a modern masculine modesty that was not necessarily related to political or social order, but ascribed to a universal natural order. By the late 19th century, courtesy literature was advocating the middle-class language of industrial simplicity. Kutcher links these changes in men's fashion to a dynamic of inconspicuous consumption, elite understatement and superior example in manly modesty. Kutcher cites John Hamilton Moore's words in his 1824 publication, The Young Gentleman and Lady's Monitor, where Moore identified little sartorial difference between, I quote, studied plainness and the frivolous man who studies the dress and not the characters of men. And Kutcher himself observes how inconspicuous consumption installed an inverted fashion system, so echoing Brouard again, one that equally demanded uniformity. And I just thought it's worth putting up Kutcher's summation of the masculine renunciation. I just thought, as I was writing about this and thinking about this inconspicuous consumption, I was just sort of reminded somewhat of the idea of normcore. And I'm not going to touch on it very, very briefly, this idea of inconspicuousness. And despite what Williams here identifies in relation to normcore, the relation, much of the discussion in relation to normcore was in relation to the adoption of understated generic uniformity of high street or mall, chain store, jeans, shorts, T-shirts, sweatshirts and trainers. So perhaps a link here again, inconspicuous consumption or seeming inconspicuous consumption. GQ picked up on this as a high fashion, noting that menswear designers like Patrick Irville and Louis Vuitton's Kim Jones have taken the classic Patagonia Retro X fleece jacket and made it luxe, and perhaps counters this simplicity and assumption. Sorry, lost my page. Nope, wrong page, sorry. So, moving on. So, Christopher Bruard, in The Hidden Consumer from 1999, observes that the great masculine renunciation provides a convenient shorthand for a limiting and impenetrable stylistic progression of cut and colour, as well as a jumping-off point for philosophical explorations of meaning surrounding a supposed resistance to differentiation and brightness by men. He counters this simplification, assumption, and shorthand by arguing that, and I quote, "the possibilities of the narrower range of men's sartorial models on offer position men at the centre of debate concerning fashion and model life, where apparently denying their participation in its wider cultural, while apparently denying their participation in its wider cultural ramifications." The first section of Bruard's book questions assumptions of denial and absence. He argues for the survival of elaboration and elegance in masculine models of beauty, which were promoted by the clothing industries, and exposes the Flugelian reading of an easy relationship between the powerful psychical inhibitions and austere dress habits as simplified and unaware of the spectrum of choice available to men, particularly in urban centres such as London. The research taken for and evidenced in this book demonstrates the breadth and complexity of men's engagement with and consumption of fashionable dress in the latter part of the 19th and early 20th century, the period in which the men's renunciation was supposedly at its peak. Bruard also notes that while Flugel's proposition would seem to be aimed at all men, 19th century commentators often identify clear distinctions between class-based visual identity and style. And this quote particularly around Clarks illustrates that. Bruard exposes how formal language and style of men's wardrobes was modified but never wholly rejected. He significantly notes the evidence of fashion plates and portraits from the 1830s to 50s that demonstrate a romantic influence in the variety of styles from skin tight to voluminous with a loudness of pattern and colour, and bore resemblance to romanticised notion of the self in literature. This contrasted with the 1860s and 70s, where there was a tendency towards close-fitting concealment and emphasis on simplicity of cut and comfort. Similarly, Tim Edwards, in Men in the Mirror, notes that Dark's modern suit of industry and commerce didn't start until the late Victorian period, at the same time when, quote, "the smartness of evening dress also reached its peak of popularity." Edwards also notes that the same men would have had all sorts of other styles in their wardrobe, tweed walking suits, hunting jackets, brightly sized seaside jackets, as well as smoking jackets in rich jewel-like colours. In an essay from the same year as the book, Bruard focuses on the consumption practice and dressed appearance of the city clerk. He proposes a crystallised variety of especially modern notions of masculinity at the big turn of the 20th century. Once again contradicting Flugel's renunciation, Bruard notes the wide range of subtly varying styles available that had, and I quote, "an almost fetishistic attention to detail in cut, texture, cut and trimmings." Bruard argues that after 1870, the period after 1870 witnessed modernisation and negotiation of men's fashionability underpinning 20th century attitudes to manliness and appropriate attire. But this can be traced further back, as discussed by Kutcher. The late 19th century also saw calls for authentic masculine behaviour that espoused the rejection of material trappings and a distancing from the fin de siècle association between fashion and decadence and depravity, evidence of unmanliness and inversion, that particularly arose following the reporting of the Cleveland Street Affair and the Oscar Wilde trials of 1889 and 1895. Joe Paoletti has similarly argued that in a major motor change in men's dress was the fear of ridicule. Ridicule for dressing in a way that strikes observers as feminine. Such renunciations, Bruard notes, went further than calls for management of sober and restrained dress of the early 19th century and was a puritanical and sentimentally self-celebrating, was puritanical and sentimentally self celebrating, linked to 17th century fundamentalist Protestantism in the context of empire building, missionary life, sporting prowess, and new professions. The evidence Brouard unearthed reveals the subtleties of men's fashionable consumption and fashionable change, while also offering up an alternative fashion rather than a clear, outright renunciation. Edwards similarly disputes that history that interprets men's dress at the unfolding and as the unfolding and uniform development of the dark three-piece suit, as well as the notion that sees male dress as resistant to fashion. He also notes the comparison between the slow modification of men's clothing in comparison to the latest fashionable changes for women in the 19th century as too extreme, noting some convergence of styles pointing out changes in overall form were faster for women, though, and I quote, the more muted changes in decoration, detail and nuance are far more similar for each of the sexes. Like Brouard, Laura Ugolini, in her 2007 Men and Menswear, sought to disabuse the idea that men were, and I quote, hidden, reluctant or non-consumers of fashionable dress until the 1980s. And she explored men's relationships with fashion and fashionability, investigating and revealing ways in which men and boys negotiated the purchase, consumption and sale of fashionable goods. While there is a crossover of date with Brouard, she brings her investigation into the interwar years, covering the dates in which Flügel was proposing his theory and in which he was involved with the Men's Dress Reform Party. Ugolini explores the relationship between consumption and identities, taking into account class, age and ethnicity, investigating the ways men constructed their identities as users, buyers and sellers of clothes. Similar to Kutcher, Ugolini unpacks the formality and rule-bound nature of society and examines the links between men's clothing consumption and organisation of power and authority, considering the class-based negotiations of rules that governed men's dress. And so while considering Flügel's writings in the psychology of clothes, as well as those commentators, and there are many more than those I have discussed, but they are, I would say, the main ones, it occurred to me that what Flügel was proposing was both a renunciation of and a renunciation by. The renunciation is of what is perceived as feminine, the decoration and colour of pre-19th century men's clothing. This relates to the idea that it is men who are renouncing, that they are masculine renouncers, if we equate men and masculinity. And I know that can be problematic. But again, it's not masculinity, or at least not a conventional hegemonic masculine presentation that's being renounced. But there is, in this, an equation of men with masculine, leading to renunciation to the by, if I may, masculine men. And within this is a presumed heterosexuality. Flügel does briefly mention homosexuality, both at the end of the sex differences chapter in relation to transvestism, and later in the chapter on individual and sexual differentiation, where he links the punishment of homosexuals to a repression of homosexual tendencies and a calling for tolerance of homosexuality. Also, to quote Flügel, as psychoanalysis has shown, there is a close developmental relation between narcissism and homosexuality. We've heard quite a bit about narcissism this morning, and I don't think there's time really to go into that. Of course, this is contentious, and one grounded in the beliefs of the period. However, I raise this because, as Brouard mentioned, there was a distinct uncomfortableness with and fleeing from the association between fashion and inversion in the late 19th and into the 20th century. Simplifying somewhat, homosexuality has historically been linked to femininity, and thus a renunciation by effeminate homosexuals of what are perceived as more masculine forms of dress and self-representation. But, as I've argued elsewhere, many gay men, historically, have dressed invisibly, adopting the dark conformist masculine styles of conventional men's dress, so renouncing. During the period of Flügel's writing, there was a reaction to this renunciation adoption of dark and sombre. As I've highlighted, Brouard discussed the move towards this in the first decades of the 20th century, and Ugolini outlines various ways men adopted new forms of fashionability. The flamboyance of aristocratic and upper-class bright young people in the 1920s revealed a challenge, sometimes rooted in adoption of late 18th century styles, but also in the wearing of non-conventional colours and styles. Cecil Beaton, for example, described his outfits he wore at Oxford in his diary on the 9th of October 1923 as, I quote, an evening jacket, red shoes, black and white trousers and a huge blue cravat. And he brightened the Cambridge scene with an outfit comprising a fur gauntlet, gloves, a cloth of gold tie, a scarlet jersey and Oxford bags. So not the renowned style that Flugel's promoting, and much more perhaps aligned to the MRDP. The Peacock Revolution of the 1960s, to jump forward, is also a period in which the renunciation has been noted to be challenged. And while I simplify for the sake of brevity, the new colourful, close-fitting styles of the early part of the decade and moves towards psychedelic and often historically referenced flamboyance of the latter part of the decade, then moving on towards a unisex, formed a renunciation of the masculine conventions of Western men's dress. The emergence of post-war youth subcultural styles, particularly in Britain, have often been cited as examples of how the masculine renunciation itself was renounced. I'd like to briefly note that today, when there's a great emphasis on the ideas of androgyny and gender neutral within fashion and dressed appearance more broadly, that there's perhaps once again a renunciation of the masculine. But also perhaps this could be seen as a feminine renunciation, a renunciation of femininity, perhaps, or the feminine. This consideration also brings to mind Jack Judith Halberstam's work on female masculinities from 1998, in which she questions the protected status of male masculinity and examines how female masculinity is offered an alternative, including during the period Flugel identifies for the great masculine renunciation. What might be interesting to discuss, to think about in more detail in another forum, are ways in which this adoption offers a parallel form of renunciation to that of the men in Flugel's proposition. Considering ideas of the masculine, Flugel's interest in nudism and the body led me to consider two other ideas I'd like to include under a heading of masculine pronunciation. Here I was thinking both of the muscularity and exposure of the new naked male body and the idea of the hypermasculine, particularly in relation to gay styles and stress and self-representation. I've paid attention to this aspect of gay male style, and particularly noted how in the early 1970s, the hypermasculine styles of gay clones were partly born out of a rejection, a renunciation maybe, of the perceived effeminacy of gay men. Mark Simpson's 1994 book, Male Impersonators, has identified ways in which both gay and straight men have performed excessive masculinity, thus becoming what he calls male impersonators, a concept Halberstam has also touched upon. An expression has been used prior to Simpson both in literature and in the popular press in Britain in the 1950s and 60s to identify homosexual men who, while attempting to remain below the radar, expose themselves as obvious because he overdoes things, to quote from Roddy Garland's 1953 novel The Heart in Exile. One of the aspects that Simpson has addressed and that has also been expressed by others in relation to moments of renunciation, of the renunciation, is the visibility of the male body as an object of consumption, offered up in advertising and other forms of visual culture, particularly from the 1980s onwards, and that's been discussed by, amongst others, in relation to the concepts of the new man of the 1980s by Frank Mortch or Nixon, Tim Edwards. Here the body, often semi-dressed, in a renunciation of the coverings of clothing, Flugel's nudity, perhaps, has been presented as a sexualised object of the gaze, both male, female, gay and straight. Edward Dottisol noted in Behold the Man, men are meat, their naked bodies hoisted up on a larger-than-life billboards and frozen in print advertisements, perhaps even now on the internet. He was writing before that. Simpson dedicates a chapter to bodybuilding, tying this and other examples to examinations of the roles of homoeroticism and narcissism in the male world, returning in some ways back to Flugel's own debates on narcissism. Like Simpson, I've explored the role of the gym-built body, both in forms of contemporary and historic advertising for underwear and the development of masculinized form of set body self-presentation by gay men. Pre-liberation as a counter to the devastation of AIDS and as a contemporary form of masculine presentation. Gay men are not, of course, alone in increased gym use and the pronunciation of forms of masculinity through bodybuilding and gym culture exist across the span of men's identities. But again, too much to go into today. In the debates around the renunciation of the great masculine renunciation, it's often been identified that it relates particularly to white Western men. Indeed, Flugel compares the restraint of the late 19th century men's clothing to other non-Western, what he calls primitive, cultures. So before I finish up, I'd like to offer one last adaptation of the great masculine renunciation concept. And for this, I'm indebted to, and we'll talk about it in relation to the work of Christina Chichinska, who proposed the idea of the masculine enunciation, specifically in relation to the dress choice of black men. So, not Chichinska, but in relation to this, Ted Polhemus, in his 1994 Street Style, notes how for Flugel the suit declared a renunciation of decoration. But for Polhemus, he states that in the case of the Zoot suit worn by African-American and Mexican-American men in urban areas in the 1940s, the suit became, and I quote, a showy, extravagant garment through its use, extravagant use of expensive fabric that loudly proclaimed of its wearer, I've got it made. More conspicuous than inconspicuous consumption, perhaps. Relating in some ways to Polhemus' identification of the Zoot suit as a contradiction to the GMR, both Chichinska and the playwright and curator Michael McMillan have discussed the suit and tailoring worn by Caribbean immigrants to the UK in the immediate post-war period. While neither discusses Flugel or the GMR explicitly in their written work, this certainly underpins their propositions about the use of dress and terms as a countering of this renunciation through ways in which such men articulated their styles through attention to detail. Drawing on Carol Tulloch's work on black dress, and her triumvirate style fashion dress, both Macmillan and Chichinska have used this photograph of three Jamaican passengers aboard aboard the SS Empire Windrush to illustrate a point about the way in which West Indian immigrants utilise their clothing, and especially the detail of their clothing, patterned ties, high-waisted tapered trousers, broad-shouldered lapels jackets, to assert both similarities to and differences from mainstream white sartorial practices. As Chichinska notes, a boldly patterned tie worn with a broad-shouldered pinstripe double-breasted suit should not work, but somehow it does. Chichinska explicitly compares the three men to an image of Edward Duke of Windsor, who I know is covered in Philip's book, but I don't think he's going to talk about today, taken at the start of World War II, and who could certainly be argued to have challenged the kind of mainstream renounced styles of men's dress. She takes this perhaps also to illustrate similarities and differences in the way in which the items and elements worn by the Windrush generation immigrants, quote, visually capture what it is to be creolized, to inhabit the in-between space, to be neither one nor the other but something else besides. Macmillan has noted in his 2016 essay Saga Boys and Rude Boys that a racialized dandy disrupts and subverts the gendered status quo as he is hyper-masculine and feminine. And it's the emphasis on detail and its similarity and differentiation from hegemonic white dress that Chichinska identifies as a masculine enunciation. She elaborated on this at an event here at LCF by talking about this image of General Jean-Jacques Dessalines, one of the leaders of the Haitian Revolution, and taking this discussion back to the period identified by Flugel as the beginning of the great masculine renunciation. She uses it to consider his appropriation of Western dress and military uniform as a means of articulating status, power and authority, and how this is juxtaposed with a geometrically patterned skullcap worn discreetly under his bicorn hat. This, she proposed, moved Dessalines' donning of French military regalia beyond mimicry into an interplay between imitation and differentiation, and reflecting a creolized aesthetic where there is no single fixed point of origin. She argues that what connects this image of Dessalines to the Windrush image is that they're each in representations of African diaspora manhood. Each symbolic male figure represents himself. What's at play is both the management of appearance and the management of an impression. So, just to sum up, Flugel's articulation of the great masculine renunciation that took place at the close of the 18th century and that set what he believed was men's approach to dress and clothing was very much grounded in his position both as a psychoanalyst, a psychologist, and drew on earlier beliefs about men's dress. While it's been employed as a shorthand to articulate differences between men's and women's fashion, as I've hopefully demonstrated, it's a somewhat simplistic explanation that runs alongside other more nuanced ideas of how men's style and fashion has appeared under alternating systems. This talk notes how So hopefully I've kind of given you some thoughts about how we might think about the great masculine enunciation and how we might move that on. Thank you.